You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
On this episode of the Fieldhouse Files, we're going to go inside the mind and have a thorough conversation on sports psychology with Dr. Chris Carr, who used to be with St. Vincent's, worked with the Pacers since November 2011. And welcome into another episode of the Fieldhouse Files. I'm Scott Agnes. Things are starting to look up NBA-wise as they continue to have discussions about what's going on with the league and how they can restart it, potentially in Orlando at Disney World, as well out in Vegas. But we'll get to all that in upcoming episodes. But first, we have a really good one in store for you today. If you haven't caught up with the show before, last few episodes have been really good. On Monday, I had a special interview with that Pacers fan, Kathy Martin Harrison from The Last Dance. I revisited the 1998 Eastern Conference Finals with Bob Kravitz. I also went one-on-one with Pacers head coach Nate McMillan. But today's a different type of episode. You're going to hear about someone behind the scenes who really doesn't speak up and, more than anything, listens. That's because Dr. Chris Carr's role is the team sports psychologist, which means trying to be proactive in helping individuals with mental health and with problems both inside the arena and the practice facility, as well as outside, at home. There's so many different things that all of us, that these players, that these coaches, because it's not just limited to players, go through on a daily basis. And so Dr. Carr is that ear for the players to go to. It is an optional service, but it's something the Pacers believe in and provide to everyone on their staff. But this is somewhat of an exit interview for him because he is moving on after almost 9 years with the team. He joined them in November 2011 and May 1st turned to a new job, left Indianapolis. Well, at least not physically yet because of COVID-19, but he is moving on to a full-time role with the Green Bay Packers, a new adventure for him and something he is really looking forward to. But one thing he's having to work on right now is trying to be productive and helpful from home and trying to make the best of not being able to currently have face-to-face conversations with those he would normally work with. So it's kind of funny, he's going from Pacers to Packers, and it's a position the Pacers absolutely plan on filling. Kevin Pritchard telling me recently that we were super happy with him. He was incredible. He has given us a name, and we have started dialogue with someone. So look forward to that. But this is a unique and fun conversation that I think you will enjoy right here on the Fieldhouse Files. All right, as promised, to bring in Dr. Chris Carr, a name you may be familiar with because of his longstanding previous relationship working with the Pacers and Indianapolis teams specifically, has since moved on and taken an exciting new role joining the Packers in a full-time capacity as their Director of Performance Psychology and Team Behavioral Health Clinician. So Dr. Carr now joining me. To start, I'm curious, what have things been like for you, Dr. Carr? You're in the middle of a transition into a new role, not exactly into a new league because you were with the Packers in a part-time role, but generally speaking, what has this been like for you? Because I would expect maybe even the demand for someone like you in your capacity has gone through the roof because of kind of the stoppage and the uncertainness kind of in our communities right now.
I think like most every profession, particularly in kind of the helping professions, were all impacted by this really unprecedented epidemic, and or I guess pandemic is the more appropriate title. You know, it's been a challenge, you know, finishing up and saying goodbye to folks and organizations that you've worked with for many years is always tough. There's a sense of loss, but at the same time, the excitement of a new opportunity in Green Bay is, you know, it's really challenging because I'm still here in the Indy area. But you know, we're finding ways through technology, through Zoom, through FaceTime, through emails to maintain communication. Even the staff that are up in the Green Bay area right now with Wisconsin in a stay at home pretty much to the end of the month, people aren't able to get into the facility. So I'm similar to everybody else, but feeling a little distance, and I'm ready to get up there and and kind of get rolling. And I know each day we go through this process, we get one day closer to being back to where we need to be.
I'm curious, because we've seen so much about the boom in video conferencing with Zooms and Microsoft Teams. What is it about a visual connection in particular right now, very helpful to feeling part of something or an interaction that maybe you can't have right now because of your inability to leave home and those sorts of things?
Yeah, it's clearly not preferable in the context of the work that I do as a psychologist. So much of the relationship building is dependent upon the ability to sit and have communication, to listen, to engage. And that includes nonverbal as well as verbal communication, which is limited when we have technology. But having done it a long time and having that experience, which you can't really read in a book, I think I have a better sense. Now, obviously, with a lot of newer players and newer folks, it may take some time. But and there's a little bit of limitations on protection of technology and having HIPAA compliant resources. So I think, you know, it's a slower transition. We're doing a lot more education with handouts. One of the things that we know in resilience study and the psychology of resilience is that you kind of have an acceptance of the challenges, you manage those emotions appropriately and have a healthy process to manage it, and then you reestablish goals, you become goal-directed, and that social support is important. So my weekly calls with staff and coaches just keeps that connection going. And as you mentioned, I think this would be much more challenging if this was my first season with going into the NFL, but this will be my third season with the team. So that familiarity already exists, and I think makes this transition a little bit easier.
Before we get into your role as a sports psychologist and trying to enhance and support the players and even staff members for wherever you are, I like the fact you're an Indiana guy, played football at Wabash, right? Was this moving into psychology, was this your way of continuing to work in sports in some capacity? And maybe how early did you discover this was a field that really excites you and you're passionate about?
I get asked that question a lot by grad students, so I have to share kind of the honest. I was a highly unrecruited 5'10", 170-pound offensive lineman out of Muncie Northside High School. So they weren't knocking down the doors for me to play at the next level. And at that time, my father had been a Wabash College graduate, and I wanted to keep playing. And so I had the opportunity to look at smaller schools and ended up at Wabash. And my senior year of high school, Wabash played in the Division III National Championship game in the Stag Bowl. And, you know, so it was a great program. And I just grew later and matured and was able to play all 4 years and start my last 2 years. And that was just such a great experience because, I mean, having that identity and able to achieve some things, I by no means was a great athlete. I maximized my abilities. And psychology kind of came in. It was about my fourth major, to be honest with you, in college. Huh. And when I drove away from Crawfordsville after my graduation, my plan was I was going to start graduate school at Ball State. I was going to live at home. I did a master's degree in counseling psychology, and I was a graduate assistant football coach for Ball State. I thought I was going to go into coaching, and that was back in the day when they used to cut film, literally film strips out of canisters, and your job as a GA, not only to getting lunch and doing all the gopher duties, you cut film, which was the most mind-numbing, boring task I could ever want to have. I learned during my counseling degree that this might be interesting, and actually, as it turned out, I chose to go the counseling route, and I worked 4 years in adolescent addictions field, 2 years in a treatment hospital, and then 2 years doing prevention work. And it was during that time that I had friends who were coaches and, you know, people that I kept connected with that told me about this field of sports psychology. And to be honest, I didn't know much about it. I researched it quite a bit because I felt like I wanted to make a career shift. Found that most people calling themselves a sports psychologist were either not a psychologist or they were a psychologist that reads sports page or coaches a youth soccer team. And sports psychology is different academic discipline. So it was at that point my wife and I talked, and I went back to do my PhD in counseling psychology with the intent of becoming a psychologist that worked with athletes. So my doctoral minor when I was doing my PhD work at Ball State was in sports psychology, and I was fortunate to go out and spend the third year of my doctoral program at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs working in the sports psychology department. And that was just such a blessing and opportunity to really go into a place and say, yeah, this is something I could do. So to be honest, Scott, you know, it kind of, this career came later to me. And once my wife and I made the decision to move forward, I haven't looked back, and I've had a blessed and wonderful 29, 30 years since that time.
When do you feel like maybe there was an acceptance or understanding of this role? Because to me, it felt like it was more like a couple of years ago, but your role in this capacity goes back all the way to the early 90s.
Well, there's quite a stigma about psychology in general, right? And because people are not quite sure how to handle what therapy is or counseling or the role of psychologist. There's a lot of stigma about a psychologist as someone you go see when you're only in trouble or there's something wrong. The field of sports psychology and performance psychology, what it's brought so much to our overall discipline is really some scientific and academic search into the areas like mental toughness, psychology of flow, resilience, hardiness. And those were the things that I think I got really kind of pulled into in working in the addictions field, because for someone to struggle with such a significant substance dependence issue and then to recover into a state of sobriety or keeping clean and living that lifestyle really took psychological strength. And I learned a lot about that. And I think I was intrigued with that and felt like sports was a natural system to build that. When I took my first position out of my PhD at Washington State University, full-time psychologist in their athletic department, I was the only person in the Pac-10 conference in that role, and one of, I think, four positions in the country that had a full-time psychologist in athletics. And now, over the past 25-plus years, you see that all Power 5 major Division I college athletic departments not only have sports psychology and mental health services for athletes, but often have multiple providers and staff members into those positions. And I think that's, we're starting to see that trend a little bit in professional sports. Last year in the NFL, the Kansas City Chiefs and Carolina Panthers both had full-time mental health sports psychology folks. And now with my role in Green Bay, the Buffalo Bills, the New York Giants, Chicago Bears, some of these teams are now making, everyone's had a clinician, but bringing it in and making it a full-time integrated part of performance and care of the players. I think it's fun to be part of that process. I was in that process very early on with the NCAA. And I think we have a generation now that sees help-seeking behavior as a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness. I think people understand that there is a mental component to athletic performance, dealing with confidence, focus, composure skills. And anyone can read a book and regurgitate information, but to really help an athlete that's at a very high level of athletic performance to integrate those interventions into their preparation and their performance, I think requires a unique skill set. So, you know, I think it's been this remarkable journey and watching the growth. I think Scott is, and to me, we should have been here before, but we're moving in the right direction for sure.
A lot of what you said at the beginning too reminds me of kind of what trainers, I'm talking about the pacer trainers, talk about a lot, is they focus on prehab. It's before the injury. And so it seems like you were very much in the same route, as just because you don't feel like you're not having anything or any issues or anything you should discuss doesn't mean you shouldn't have someone to talk to. And that said, do you find that oftentimes is the case of trying to say, hey, let me talk to you, even though maybe you don't feel like there is a need right now. Let's see if I can help you out. Just give me a chance, so to speak.
Well, I think the one thing that's connected to a position like this is particularly in the professional level, and I think to a certain degree at the collegiate level, although I think the collegiate level still adheres to the principles and values of overall development of the person. And I think a lot of Division I athletic departments and Division II and III do a wonderful job at providing those resources to their student athletes. But in professional sports, it's clearly about the ability to perform. And one of the things that I will do at the beginning of any training camp and any kind of professional team I've worked with is do some teaching and education about sports psychology. And a common question I use with teams is, you know, what percent of your sport do you believe is mental? Yeah. That has to deal with confidence and focus. And typically with elite athletes, they're going to say 90% or more of their sport is mental at that level, because their physical talents and abilities to get to that level are so unique. And now at this point, from a talent and skill standpoint, it's a very homogeneous, similar group. So they recognize there's a huge mental component. The second question I'll ask is, of the mistakes you make as a performer, what percent of your mistakes would you say are mental mistakes, where you got distracted or you lost your focus or you had some doubt or hesitation or you got too tight? And most elite athletes will say, almost all my mistakes are mental mistakes. I have the ability to do the task. I just didn't perform it when I needed to or when the moment counted. So once they've identified their sport is mostly mental and their mistakes, then I ask, how much time do you spend training that part? Because we have these extravagant, very well outfitted strength rooms, training facilities, I mean, recovery facilities. But how much time do you spend working on that mental part? And that's what brings a lot of athletes in initially, is to really kind of sit down and assess what they've done in the past. You know, I've watched over the years more and more athletes coming into the professional level that have had experience. Sometimes the experience hasn't been a good experience. It's been more of a guru or a gimmick and not really a integrated part of their development. So to that extent, Scott, I think that's where, you know, really good and competent professionals can make that relationship develop with the athletes and the staff and do a lot of education. And then ultimately requires the athlete to commit to the process, because as I tell them, I can't do the mental training to you. That's something you have to choose to do and go work with those tools and then utilize me to go through that process. And I think the other piece too, the whole idea of psychology, the idea that psychologists can only do therapy and they can only treat depression or anxiety, I think that's part of the stigma as well, because I think those of us that have trained in the past 20 something years and have a combination of training, you know, once the athlete comes in the office, no matter what it is, we're going to be able to help navigate that and give them the best support and resource available. So it is a unique skill set. And there are more and more programs that are developing academic training in this area and supervised experiences, internships, but it's still growing and needs to grow quite a bit.
I immediately thought of that old quote, right? Mental is to physical as four is to one. That stood out. And then the fact that, yeah, you can't hold their hand to go through the process. They have to commit to you. You can open their eyes to what you and the field is about, but they really have to commit to you in all this. I'm curious too, and when it comes to focus, just kind of in general, and probably my generation and those behind me, you know, we're used to our phones and instant gratification on Twitter and those sorts of things. And I've heard coaches, right, holding, you know, shorter meetings. Maybe you have a 30-minute film session, you go practice, then have another film session rather than those extravagant hour and 2 hour type things. Is those kind of things and issues that you've had to really help both teams and individuals work past?
Absolutely. There, you know, the culture changes and our learning styles change and our learning processes change. You know, it's been, to me, it's just a fascinating contextual process. And the use of apps and other kinds of interventions on phones and helping athletes kind of incorporate that. I mean, it's wonderfully challenging for me, but yet to this day, I find that those elite athletes, those really top of the top, they just do things that are best for them. And they really put effort and energy and focus into that preparation. And if you look at some of the research on flow state, which is that optimal state of performance, so an athlete who's having a world record performance or scoring 50 points in a game or throwing for 400 yards or whatever you would define, they often talk about that as kind of being in the zone and that flow. There is a certain level of attention and focus that's required to be in flow state that you may not be able to achieve in your normal day-to-day activities, you know, switching apps and looking back and forth.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the mental training becomes so much more important for these elite athletes, because the sporting environment is always changing. The intensity of the environment, you know, whether it's an NBA arena, playing in an opposing arena, or an NFL stadium, or a college or a football stadium or arena. I mean, there are so many distractions and things that you can kind of deal with in the environment. And if you're easily distracted, it can take you away from that flow state or the opportunity to be in the zone. So to me, a really committed athlete is going to use tools that can kind of help them with their setting goals, can help them be focused on the goals that they need to be focused on, can help them with their attention, managing the arousal levels, the intensity, and really have good routines that prepare them to be at or near their best performance, not just when they compete, but in their practice and training as well. So it is fascinating. And for me, that's where our research branch kind of our field needs to be better at kind of looking at those factors that impact the mental preparation and focus.
You mentioned initially being interested in coaching, but the more we talk, the more I have seen, it feels like you're kind of an assistant coach in a way. You're just, instead of diagramming defensive plays like a Dan Burke might provide, you're coming in there with the mental aspect or the focus, or why is the team committing so many turnovers, let's say, late in the game. How receptive in general have coaches been to your work and maybe setting assigned time for each individual to come through your office and those sorts of things? How much has that changed in recent years?
You know, fortunately for me, and I know there's different transitions and times, but I've been blessed that, you know, 90% or such of coaching staffs I've dealt with, whether they're Division I athletic departments or professional teams, have been wonderfully supportive of the role.
Nice.
And that's part of building relationships and teaching. And I love doing coaching development because coaches are performers as well. And coaches have to know what to focus on and when to focus on it. So I'm always fascinated, you know, in creating kind of a library of coaching psychology principles and communication skills and teaching skills. So, you know, when I get coaches that are receptive to that, it's such a collaborative venture. It works really well. And for me, if I don't have that support from the coaches, then the players' utilization of me as a resource is going to be much more limited, because players know when the coaches believe in it, and players know when the coaches believe in it as an asset, as a strength-building component, versus a coach that views my role as, you're having problems, go see Doc. And that's a different kind of expectation, because it's assuming there has to be the injury or something that happens first. And that's where you made reference to, you know, the athletic training staff and sports medicine staff. You know, during the years I was with the Pacers, I was considered part of the performance staff with our strength conditioning staff, our athletic training staff, our nutrition, myself being integrated so you could surround the players with the best resources. What was different was, you know, you can't really mandate them to do my stuff, because if you don't have that internal commitment. But
right.
I would tell you what I've noticed just anecdotally in this 30-something years of practice, it's kind of the standard distribution curve, that when I go into a team, I know that, that at one end there's going to be 10% of athletes that no matter how polished or how much education or experience I have, they ain't ever going to meet with me. Mm-hmm. And then at the other end, there's about 10% that are going to start scheduling appointments as soon as I'm done doing my presentation. And then about the 80% in between kind of vacillate. But what I have found is over time, if you kind of present yourself as a resource and as a professional, not as a guru or a sage or, you know, a gimmick, if you present yourself as a professional in what you do, you build and endurance of athletes that come in and feel in a confidential, trusted environment that they can get better. And then as they speak about it as part of their preparation, just enhances your role And I think that's where sports medicine has evolved, and even strength and conditioning to an extent. There were many years ago, you didn't have strength coaches, and you surely didn't have performance dietitians and nutritionists. But as we expand our sports science, I think the role of psychology and mental health is so important. And that's what's exciting about the work I do and the opportunities I've had.
And the thing I was been fascinated with too, especially over the last few years, it's not like you're around once a week or anything. If, say, the Pacers would go on a road trip, it's a high percentage that you would be there. So you would be that resource available to them when they have this free time, when they're alone in a hotel room with no one else to talk with, and those sorts of things. And on top of that, a lot of what you do, from what I see, is just observing and jotting down notes, and probably, I don't know if it's things you go back to in your conversations with them or what have you, but you're constantly evaluating individuals and probably team body language and things like that.
Well, I think part of being a behavioral observer is part of your role. I unfortunately, there's people who will observe and then make global statements of definitive response. Well, the team is this. Well, I don't make those global statements. I make observations, and then you look at patterns over time. A lot of times when I would be doing reflection, it's basically my own assessment of what's happening, or my own observation or curiosities. And oftentimes none of that stuff really gets transmitted anywhere beyond my own experience and my own opportunity to grow as a professional. Now, I do have some athletes in my work with them who are asking me to share those observations and watch for certain conduct and behaviors, and because they want to be better and they want a neutral yet aware observer. And what the value of going into a full-time position is going to be that visibility, that relationship building. And I think when athletes see you as an integrated part of their culture and their environment, and you have a professional skill set to operate from, I think you can engender a sense of trust in them, because when they sit down and talk about the challenges they struggle with and they face, they're talking to someone who's seen it and understands it. It may not from the same experience as them, but very clearly from the experience of, yes, I can see how that would be an impact. So, you know, even in this new position I've taken, one of the things that was brought up to me during the process was by one of the folks in kind of the top administration was, we see this opportunity as a chance for you to connect with those players who come by your office when you're not in town. And that's when they needed to talk. Mm-hmm. And now by making it more accessible, and I think the whole bottom line of committing a position to it also validates that this is an important piece of your development as an athlete. I think if you're brought in on a part-time and once in a while kind of basis and you're not really visible, I think you retain in that context of, well, there has to be something wrong for you to go seek that help.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. That speaks volumes about how they feel about you and the growth in that profession, and how maybe more accepting or confident they are in that capacity. One thing in particular I'm curious about, because something I think fans and even media get into, is body language, particularly maybe on the bench late in games, and whether a team's cheering for each other or what have you. How much is body language something that impacts a person's mental well-being and maybe a team capacity as well?
One of the things that we're taught, and I always try to, I spent 6 years consulting with the Kansas City Royals, and I remember the first spring training I went to, I had a minor league coach come up after my presentation and kind of said, I know the kind of stuff you do. I took a class when I was in college. And I said, I kind of looked back at him and I didn't have a problem saying, you know, I played baseball till I was in seventh grade. I don't think that means I can do what you do. There is a sense of projective awareness that you're trained during your 6-7 years of graduate training as a psychologist. And that's really related to your comment. So when someone says their body language is poor, if a fan or someone is saying it, it's coming from their place of relevance. If they're not feeling good about a team's getting beat by 20 points, and a person is already feeling as a fan that sense of disappointment or frustration or whatever, and then they look at someone's behavior, they're going to project their own thoughts into that observation they have. What I've learned over the years is the best feedback I can give to a player is, I noticed in this moment, this was how you looked. What was going on with you during that time? Rather than me to try to project and say, boy, your body language was bad, but rather say what was going on during that time. And that gives individuals a chance to be aware of how their body language impacts their communication, their team dynamic. It's a fascinating piece of my role, and I would trust myself. I've been in so many different places, to 2 Olympic Games, NCAA championships, all the different things I've been to. You get kind of your own individualized catalog sense of how players are going to respond in certain situations. That's where the relationship is so important, because as I build a relationship with a player over time who's committed to working on their mental skill set, then you're able to watch them in practice and in competitions and be able to see patterns of behavior, so that if they're on the bench or the sidelines and someone says, boy, their body language is bad, well, maybe it's not bad body language. Maybe it's just how they manage and reset themselves, but perceived everybody else it looks bad. And I think that's human behavior. And I think that's, you know, the whole sports context is about assumptions and interpretations of a behavior or something that's seen that may or may not fact be true.
I assume you've been watching this, The Last Dance with Michael Jordan. What do you make of how much we interpret MJ and how the one of the many ways he's a dominant player is that the end justifies the means, right? And how he treats people and goes about his business every single day. What do you make of his motivational tactics?
Well, I think there's generational changes, because you think of the years that he played and the context of how players came into that system back in those days, typically coming out of collegiate programs instead of straight out of AAU. I think there's so many factors that are involved. I'll tell you, a lot of those documentaries and everything are interesting to me, but they're so edited and there's so many different variations of how the story could go. So I kind of, so to speak, take it with a grain of salt. What was impactful, and I think it's been probably replicated multiple times since even, was when he was talking about, you know, how badly did you want to win, and if you were a teammate, and you could see that emotion come in him. That was legit. That was genuine. And I have found that those types of athletes, they really do things different, and they can't really understand how other people that maybe have even more talent can't commit to the same behaviors and kind of motivations. And I think that's what separates. I mean, there's the top 20 for a reason, right? Not top 200, top 20 for a reason. You separate that elite level. So I think it's a fascinating study of the different dynamics. It's, you know, it's a unique story, but I always, as I would say, there's always stories behind the story.
Sure. Yeah. There's 200 hours cut down to 10 hours. Right.
Exactly. So at some point, a producer, director is editing and making choices about things that are going to be on TV versus maybe something that, in my view, might have been more impactful that was on the cutting floor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you just have to put perspective into anything you watch from that aspect.
I do think it's also a little bit real, though, because you have players talk about it and discuss it. And so it clearly stuck out to them in some capacity. And this is just me talking, but this is one reason I think, for instance, Michael Jordan has not been successful and as an exec, and maybe why Peyton Manning could not be a coach, because they outwork people. They have a different level of intensity. And, you know, it'd be hard for them to go to work and not see someone work as hard or be as committed to that type of role. And so I kind of laugh knowing that Jordan's kind of in Florida hanging out and maybe not putting a lot of work from our vantage point into his Hornets. I don't know. That's just me talking here. We do see the NBA has partnered with Headspace. LeBron's worked with Calm. There's more apps coming out. And Dr. Carr, this is probably a time more than any, at least in recent history, where folks like you and some meditation and journaling and really taking time for yourself is needed. What would you suggest to them to kind of find some inner peace and calmness in a time of concern and worry?
Well, you know, one of the things that I'll encourage folks, and I've written about this with some handouts that have been, you know, in both organizations, with Pacers and even within St. Vincent, the two organizations I've just kind of moved on from, as well as, you know, moving into a new organization. But, you know, my approach is, yes, there's a coping process in any kind of situational stressor, like this is a situation with the COVID-19 pandemic and how it's impacting. This is an external thing that we don't have control over. But one of the things that I do, even with the individual athletes, is I talk about choosing how you're going to respond. We're not responsible for the things that happen to us. We don't always control the things that happen to us, but we are responsible and have choice over how we respond. So if a person wants to get through the situation and end up being a little better than they were or growing through it, then you have to kind of decide that you're going to choose to be resilient. And we know when people struggle through adversity, there's different ways that you come back from that. You either come back worse than you were, you come back the same that you were, or you come back a little better than you were as a result of that. And that's the type of research that I like to read and kind of stay up on, not just stories, but, you know, actual factors that are contributing to that. So a couple things that I've encouraged is, number one, accept that this is an unusual event and that every day is going to be a little different and there's going to be losses of communication, as you said, going to the coffee shop, those types of things. But once we acknowledge those, have a way to kind of acknowledge it. And that's why I encourage journaling. I encourage having, you know, communication with friends, you know, staying socially connected, which is another big important piece of recovering from setbacks. We know, for example, with psychology of injury, that not only engaging in mental skills to help come back, but keeping those social connections is so important. I think the other thing is being very goal-directed, establishing two or three goals every day that you're going to work on, even if you're working from home. Even if the goal is reaching out to family members or doing a Skype or a FaceTime or a Zoom meeting, being very intentional about achieving tasks that are tasks that you control. I think staying physically active and being able to kind of get out and engage with the outdoors, taking walks, doing things to slow down and be grateful are strategies that allow us to navigate and move through tougher situations. And with intentional goal setting, and you start to accomplish and check things off your list, you maintain that sense of achievement and accomplishment that a lot of people feel they're missing because they're not going to practice or doing things every day. But there are things like mental imagery, there are visualization strategies, there are things that can be established that can help you work through a process like we're going through now. And that can be anybody in any situation, but you got to make the choice that you want to be resilient because you want to take that self-determination and that self-direction in how you respond.
It's amazing to me. I know how impactful that you have been, because a lot of the things you are talking about is things I've talked with Pacer players about and have heard them discuss, even with them initiating the conversation. Whether it's journaling or mental imagery, and you know, you hear about guys talking about, I daydreamed the night before about the big win or about that big playoff game, and the communication. I think you've really left a mark. Certainly, I know with the Pacers, and they really appreciated you. It's a position Kevin Pritchard thinks highly of, and is, I know he was talking. He told me last month he was talking with you, trying to find a replacement, because that's how much he thinks about you and your role. Is there anything else as we wind up this conversation, more about this profession or the stigmas around it that you'd want to discuss? Anything that jumps out?
No, you know, Scott, I think I think those of us that are really making a commitment to our profession to be as ethical and competent and skilled and, you know, these same tools that I encourage athletes, I use for myself, because I want to be elite in my own profession. I want to be an optimal performer, whether that's sitting down with an individual athlete or meeting with a team or a position group or a group of coaches. I don't ever want to see myself as being less than my best when I have the opportunity to engage and be involved. So I really practice what I teach, not preach, teach. You know, it's motivation comes from within. And yes, there are sometimes the external motivators that are part of what guides us, but internal motivation will clearly guide you to the best level of achievement. And I think in any given discipline, I'm just hopeful that as our field kind of continues to advance, that psychology is respected in a positive way as a resource. I think in the past year with Kevin Love and DeMar DeRozan and some of our players in the NBA and the NFL and Major League Baseball and NHL speaking about the importance, our Olympians like a Michael Phelps or Allison Schmidt, you know, some of our elite swimmers that have dominated the world stage for so long, talking about going through it, that it normalizes that, you know, that this is an important part of the human experience. And all of these individuals I work with, they may be gifted and talented athletes, but they're human beings that have families, that have relationships, that have challenges and stressors. And I think that's, you know, the value I hope to play in my continued role is being that support, because I think when people feel a well-rounded sense of self and they have their physical taken care of, their spiritual taken care of, their mental and their emotional and their behavioral taken care of, that sets the stage for being the kind of performer you want to be, whether that's a surgeon, a musician, a long road truck driver, whatever profession, to be the best that you can be. And, you know, you started this off with why you came. Well, I wasn't one of those gifted athletes. I that wasn't my nature, but I was always striving to achieve goals and be as good as I could be. And to be honest, blowing my knee out in the Monat Bell game my senior year probably is the seed of why psychology was so interesting to me, because dealing with the physical part of that, you know, injury and then the post and rehab wasn't half as hard as the mental part. And I think, you know, when I started working with injured athletes and providing kind of supportive counseling and proactive interventions, I could resonate with that, because it was, wow, there's this whole part that you kind of have your identity taken away in one play in the most important of the games maybe you played in your life. And so few will ever kind of understand what that feels like. But to come to terms with that and come to peace with it and move on from it, I mean, all of us out there, and particularly those athletes that every day kind of put their challenge and get picked apart. I mean, even like when Facebook, when the Packers put out the press release about my new position and it was on their Facebook page, I told my family, do not go to that page. I said, do not read the comments, and whatever you do, do not reply to those comments, because you don't realize that, boy, everybody has an opinion about everything. And it's sad in some ways that, you know, and sad in times where we need the challenge and adversity that people want to tear down instead of build up. And so I think, you know, this kind of story is a great opportunity, because people, I think that my colleagues that I've known for many years, we do it because it's in our heart to help other people and be that resource. It helps our clients, our athletes, kind of work through their own challenges and just listen, feedback, give them tools. So when they have that kind of success, that's awesome. To hear that you were impactful and help people, that's awesome, because that's ultimately, you know, my goal for doing this is to help people get better.
Yeah, and man, you brought up two significant areas that go even away from the floor, right? The injury, significant injury. We had that with Paul George, with Victor Oladipo, and they both talked about times when you think about quitting or will you ever play again, and trying to overcome those obstacles. I'm sure guys, and have their identity taken away from them. I'm sure they're making money, but that's not who they are, and they're away from the game for more than a year. And then you go into the social media aspect and all this, and I even wrote this year about where Miles Turner, and you can't talk about this, obviously, but Miles Turner turning off social media, and Malcolm Brogdon doesn't believe in it, and why TJ McConnell stays off of it. And all that is really interesting to me, because you're right. There's, depending on how one utilizes their feed and who they follow, they're going to be impacted, right? But how, and is it favorably? So at a minimum, it's probably best for these players to avoid their mentions and perhaps use it simply as a tool and as a news feed. So I really appreciate those two last
thoughts. And I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, again, the psychology of injury, we've grown to the part now where it's an expectation that I work with injured players, not just let's wait. It's part of right in the process early. And we start with that, and that's a part of your care. And the social media, you know, it's around, but I think we have to understand we choose what we want to attend to. We choose what we want to read. We unfortunately live in a world that can often be cruel. We've seen a lot of cruel things on behalf of people, and in a place where you can hide and not really be accountable. You know, that's, athletes are in a unique culture. They're in a fishbowl. And you know, I really empathize with some of the issues that they go through, and that's okay for people to challenge, well, you know, that's just sports and they get paid. Yeah, I've worked with lots of high-risk performers, and not just in the athletics world. And I guess I respect and admire their process to be elite, and if I can be a resource to help them be even a little bit better and help them when the challenges are in front of them, then I'm happy doing that. And like I said at the beginning, I've been blessed to have the career I've had, and I'm hopeful to see training programs put out new psychologists that have that kind of training, and hopefully they're patient to develop their experiences that will lend even more knowledge to what they do.
I truly enjoyed this, and I wanted to have some kind of an exit interview, if you will. I'd wanted to talk to you for quite a while, but now that you're leaving us and moving on to the NFL and specifically the Green Bay Packers, I'm glad you made time, and I really appreciate this. I think a lot of people, Dr. Carr, can get a lot out of this, whether you're a Pacers fan, Indy sports fan, or just curious about this field and how it can impact you. So thanks so much for the time.
Absolutely, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Well, that was Dr. Chris Carr. My thanks to him for taking time during this down period to finally have this long overdue conversation. I know that I got a lot out of it, and hopefully you did as well. There was a couple times after recording it that I went back to listen because I wanted to hear once again what he had to say and about certain techniques, certainly, that he believes in. If you haven't done so already, subscribe to the Fieldhouse Files podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you listen to your podcast. We are on there and would really appreciate you both subscribing and taking about 20 seconds to leave a 5-star review. That will do it for this week's episode, a bonus week. We brought you 2 episodes of the Fieldhouse Files this week, and I'll talk to you again soon.